Okay. So, can you elaborate as to some of your training that led up to your radar positioning?
Yes. The first course is the basic Americans call them intercept directors. We call them intercept controllers. And the course was at Tyndall Air Force Base. It was largely done simulated, but you had some live flying as well. It was a 2-month course. You learned all about the air defense system, its configuration, and you did the practical work of actually controlling fighters on targets on the range over the Gulf of Mexico. Once you finished that type of training, you were sent back to your unit. You're a basic intercept controller, but you have to be declared operationally ready. So that's done upon the availability of fighter aircraft that you can be assigned to control. Once you're combat ready, then you're free to run intercepts against civilian unknown targets, that sort of thing, or against each other for practice. That's about all I did for the first 3 years in Beaver Bank, except that I became a crew officer in charge of a crew, and the crew's job being to detect aircraft, pair them with flight plans, declare them friendly or unknown, and the rest of it was personnel management. The crew was about 40 airmen and airwomen, and some senior NCOs, junior NCOs, and other ranks. So mostly I became a crew supervisor on sh doing shift work, 24 hours, 24/7 coverage, of course. Your shifts were normally 6 days on and 2 days off. Either a stretch of midnights, a stretch of evenings, or a stretch of days. And then I moved from there to Edgar, Ontario. Edgar was a little different. They didn't have to do identification because they were an interior radar, but they did more intercept work because they had four fighter squadrons that they shared with two other radar sites, or four other radar sites, perhaps. But one day we would get 433 squadron to train with, and another day from North Bay, and another day we'd get a squadron from Ottawa, or a different squadron from North Bay. And so daily it would just intercept practice.
That's awesome. Can you elaborate as to the intercept practice that you did or the experiences that you had there?
Normally, the practice. An absolutely normal practice would be a pair of fighters, that's two flying as a section, against a target, usually a T-33 trainer type aircraft. And you would just go to an area within your radar coverage that was free of airways, preferably. And then you would set the T-33 to course north and south, while you set up to intercept it. I was selected while at Edgar to go to a weapons control proficiency unit, weapons practice unit at Cold Lake to take advanced controller training where you did live firing on the range, on the air-to-air range in Cold Lake. I also, and this is a highlight of my career, was selected to control 433 Squadron in what was the third annual McBrien Trophy rocket firing meet at Cold Lake. My squadron won, and I won the controller portion of the McBrien Trophy. I did not win the best controller at the meet. I had the first perfect run, but after that, my scores were just a little bit down, but it didn't hurt my squadron at all. And they won, and they were happy. And my CO was happy because it put a feather in our unit's cap. 31 Radar Squadron was the squadron's name at at Edgar, Ontario.
That's great. You also In your biography, you mentioned that you actually fired off a Bomark as a controller.
I went to the Bomarks were launched from Tyndall Air Force Base in Panama City, Florida, but the control facility that controlled them on the range and over was at Montgomery, Alabama. And I was assigned for a live Bomark experience. It launched. You got control of it electronically, and then your actions on the computer could steer it against the target. Ryan Firebee drones. So basically, the way the Sage computer worked is you had a target, you had your interceptors, and they were on displays, and or in this case, the Bomark is a display, and you just take an action with a bunch of buttons on the side. These things were all hardwired scopes. They're not like modern computers, multifunctional. And you could take a pairing action and pair the rocket against the target. And then the computer took over and completed the intercept. You had nobody to talk to, so you couldn't give any direction. But it was an experience. Now, if you want to talk a little more about the Bomark missile itself, I have some personal attitude about the machine. I thought it would have been effective against bombers, but it was fundamentally insane, if you'll excuse me, because it had a big enough warhead that if you, at North Bay, our Bomarks were located right in North Bay. Basically, we'd be attacking bombers coming in from the north. If the bombers were high altitude, not such a problem. The Bomark would explode in front of them. The idea was that the radiation pulse would disarm, if not disarm, but make it inoperable the weapons on board the bomber, and also the radiation pulse would eventually kill the crew. But let's say the bomber was the Bomark could explode as low as 8,000 feet. Well, let's say the bomber happened to be over Kapuskasing or Cochrane, Ontario, and exploded at 8,000 feet over the town. Probably a good portion of that population would, if not, they wouldn't necessarily be killed outright, but they might die eventually of radiation sickness of some sort. I always thought, this is crazy.
I can definitely see that. There's also mention that you were posted to an Arctic radar station. Could you elaborate a bit more on
Yes.
that?
My career path took me from Edgar to take the semi-automatic ground environment training in Richards-Gabor Air Force Base, Missouri. Following that, I was posted to Sault Ste. Marie Air Defense Sector in K.I. Sawyer Air Force Base, just south of Marquette, Michigan, which is on the shores of Lake Superior. I was there during the Cuban Missile Crisis, which we can discuss later. I became an expert weapons controller while stationed there on Sage. I became a training and standards officer, setting the training standards for all the rest of the intercept directors there. Was posted subsequently to the new underground complex in North Bay, which was then called Ottawa Sector, and spent 3 years there as a weapons director and an intercept director. They're two different positions. Then I was posted to Fox, Maine, Dew Line Site, Fox, Maine, which was in a small village called Hall Beach on the Melville Peninsula, about 600 miles north of the Arctic Circle and about 1,800 miles north of nautical miles north of Winnipeg. Supply up there was done by a vertical DC-4 that flew up and dropped supplies. While up there, you tracked anything that came towards the dew line and passed the information on. You had no interceptors. There's nothing you could do about it. If it was a Russian bomber, usually you could identify the aircraft by flight plan. It would be some airliner doing an over the pole, like London to Los Angeles would roughly come through our area. So, and you would get a flight plan and you would identify it. Anything you couldn't identify, if it left your coverage going south as an unknown, NORAD would alert forces to the south. Your information went directly to NORAD, Cheyenne Mountain Complex. The Arctic was interesting for the environs and the other activities, search and rescue, that sort of thing, because you were the only military representatives there. All the Dew Line employees were civilian contractors. So when something happened, like we lost a snow machine, a 13-passenger Bombardier snow machine on the ice floe. I had given it permission. Was acting CO at the time for one of my officers to go on it to Igloolik, which is 90 miles as the crow flies. But they should have had a crow navigating them because the white guy driving the thing wouldn't listen to his Eskimo guide. And they ended up on the ice floes. And the ice floes broke away and floated out into the Fox Basin. And due to the good works of the RCMP detachment commander in Igloolik, he found a couple of old Eskimos that hunted the ice floes. And he asked them, he showed them the tracks. Are they in the water? No, they're out there. Can you get them? Yes. The technology, snow machine wouldn't have done it because the ice pans kind of stick together and then they get thin ice in between. The leads get a little bit frozen. A sled dog is on a fan hitch. He won't walk on ice that won't hold him. The sleigh he's pulling is about 24 feet long, akumatuk. So the Eskimos running along beside it or riding on it with these dogs charging along. If they cross the lead, it's okay for them, but it might not be for him. He hops on the sleigh. Two sleighs went out, picked up the 13 people, and brought them back. That was an exciting time for me. The sad thing, the officer was a U.S. Air Force officer. He was my captain. And when we hadn't been able to find them for about 24 hours, and the tracks had ended at open water, it showed where there's tracks here and now there's open water. I had missing and presumed drowned because we had aircraft up there, civilian contractor aircraft looking for them and couldn't see them. It was the Eskimos on the ground that found the Inuit on the ground that found them. Eskimos in those days, Inuit today, sorry, to be politically correct. Brilliant navigators in their own environment. That's not NORAD defense, but it's part of the reality of living in that kind of a difficult, dangerous environment, if you're not aware.
Indeed. You mentioned the Cuban Missile Crisis. Could you elaborate to us your experiences on that?
Yes, I was at K.I. Sawyer Air Force Base, which was at the time, it's closed now, a Strategic Air Command base with B-52H bombers, which were the latest model of the B-52 bomber, equipped with Hound Dog missiles, plus their interior bomb load. The Hound Dogs were air-to-surface missiles with fairly long range and nuclear warheads. Their strategic ops assignment in the event of a crisis was to fly north and patrol just outside of Russian territorial waters until they got the go code. Now, contrary to popular belief, the way the go code worked is that they didn't go on attack if they didn't get if they didn't get it. If they didn't get a go code, they had to come home. The fail-safe was that if you lost communications, you came home. So our bombers out of KI Soyer were on their Strategic Air Command had gone to DEFCON 1, which is one level below air defense emergency, which is actual war. And they were doing a DEFCON 1 patrol of the Russian boundaries during the missile crisis. Air defense went to DEFCON 3, which is two steps down from DEFCON 1, but means 24 hours on alert. All the fighters no longer training, sitting on the ground waiting to be launched in the event of an attack. So we went, I don't know how long it lasted, I can't remember, but it was somewhere around a month that we were 24/7, two shifts, each one doing 12 hours and then going home to sleep and then back. It was tense enough at the time that many of the Strategic Air Command pilots, especially the tanker pilots, because when they went on their strategic off-plan assignment, it was overseas somewhere. I think it was in Spain or it may have been in Turkey. So the whole tanker squadron, and that's to sit position to refuel bombers attacking Russia from that direction. Our bombers out of KI Soyer were probably refueled by other tankers. Maybe they used to have some based at Churchill, Manitoba. We in air defense just sat and monitored the scopes day after day waiting for it to happen. The SAC people sent their families, some of them sent their families away to be off the base because we were a prime target for Russian missiles. I had a conversation with my wife, and I think this is important socially. What do you want to do? Is there anywhere we could send you that you would want to be or where you would feel safer? She said, no. We're in this together. If it happens, no place will be safe. So we might as well stay here. And so we wrote it out, and of course, all the rest is history. Khrushchev backed down, and Kennedy won. Let me talk about the political. What happened was that Diefenbaker did not agree to put the military on full alert concomitant with the American forces. We were co-manned with American forces. There were American forces in Canada. There were Canadian forces at every site that overlooked Canadian territory. There were Canadians as far south in the NORAD system as Montgomery, Alabama. Diefenbaker didn't put the wouldn't order the military onto alert. He refused when Kennedy requested it. As a result, some American commanders sent their Canadians home. Our commander, a man of Italian descent and kind of a tough guy, look and persona, former fighter pilot, Colonel Devania, said, the Canadians represent my most greatest experience among the crews. I can't afford to have you go home. So our colonel, full colonel, group captain at the time, called us together and said, what do you people want to do? Well, to a man, everybody immediately said, of course, we will work. And so we worked the Cuban Missile Crisis. For however long it took. And this is politically sensitive at the time, but probably not anymore. What our chief of defense staff did, called each of his commanders or sent a signal to them or something, or a teletype, and said, you are to consider yourself to be on the same level of alert as U.S. forces without actually declaring it. So every base went on the full alert without declaring it. Very politically astute, because he didn't break any rules. He just said, consider yourself to be.
That is actually really interesting.
It is.
You, in sort of a continuation of that, you mentioned that the bases were co-manned by the Canadians and the Americans. What were your experiences with the cooperation between them?
In every one that I experienced, it was superb, really. We had Americans at North Bay, including a deputy commander. In each of the sectors and each of the regions, there was a U.S. on an American located site. The head guy was an American. The number two guy was Canadian. That was all the way up to NORAD, Cheyenne Mountain Complex. The NORAD commander was an American. His deputy was a Canadian. Crews were, the percentage, I think at K.I. Sawyer, there would be several hundred people on all three crews. The Canadians represented a handful, really, in relative to the total number. I think we had probably four or five intercept directors. I became a training and standards officer. I had a crew of senior NCOs and junior NCOs who were training techs. And we trained all the new officers that came in intercept direction. And my crew were totally loyal to me all the time. They didn't resent the fact I was a Canadian. I'm sure we just got along really well. Anytime I took training down there, because we had an advantage over many of the Americans, many of us had more experience. The American officer would be a second lieutenant, just brand new out of boot camp to that course. Our guy would have been at a radar site for a couple of years already, or in my case, it was half a year, and had already done all of this stuff. So we usually outshone the Americans on the course. You know, the Canadians usually topped the course because they already had the experience when they got there.
That is really great, actually. You have been to quite a few bases and obviously have many experiences from these bases. Could you elaborate as to a few? Or
yes, let's go back to K.I. Sawyer Air Force Base, Sault Ste. Marie Air Defense Sector. While I was there, there was a, and it's the one and only in all the time I was in air defense, total continental-wide air defense exercise in which they grounded all civilian air traffic totally after something like 11 o'clock at night, and it remained grounded till 6 o'clock in the morning, while Strategic Air Command launched all of their forces flying an attack against the given sector, Washington, Great Falls, North Dakota, and so on, Duluth sector. And in every division, ours was the 30th Division, in every division and sector except ours, the attack was designed by the intelligence people who said, if the Russians attack, they'll do this. These will be their tactics, okay? And so SAC were required to fly a B-52, for example, in this within the same airspeed altitude parameters of a Bear aircraft. Just as an example, the B-58 Hustler, I think if it flew like an equivalent Russian jet, supersonic bomber. In our division, SAC said, well, we'll do this for air defense, but we also need to test our attack parameters against Russia. So we want to attack 30th Air Division sectors the same way we would attack in Russia, using the tactics we use in Russia. These are top secret. And there was a designation that sovereign secrets were no foreign. They were declared no foreign. This is such a high level of intelligence from the US that a foreigner can't have it, even though he's an ally, okay? So the SAC attack parameters were no foreign. But I was a training and standards officer monitoring the attack and evaluating the attack as it came through. The B-52s came across Lake Superior at practically zero altitude, putting complaints all across the south shore of Lake Superior of people complaining about this big airplane just about took the roof off my house. They were that low as they came across the water and just climbed up. They were flying nap of the earth. An amazing display. They used the B-47 bombers, which were electronic warfare aircraft that dropped, they jammed electronically and they dropped chaff to obscure radar coverage. They flew a pattern we had never seen before. They basket wove. So the chaff patterns went like this and created this whole huge blanket area in your radar coverage. And then as the bombers were coming low level over the water and up over the land, the B-58 Hustlers came in at 48,000 to 50,000 feet at Mach 2, double the speed of sound. Now, Voodoo aircraft, which we had, and even F-106s, Voodoos could get up to about Mach 1.6. F-106s could do maybe Mach 1.8. But attacking the Hustlers almost 100% got through. Because the type of attack to launch the rocket that the Voodoo carried, or the F-106, was called an MB-1. It was a ballistic rocket. It wasn't a guided rocket. It wasn't a missile. It was ballistic. They flew against the target as they went in at a certain altitude, say 35,000 feet. As the target approached, the fire control system would have them do what did we call it? Snap up. The rocket was then launched to fly ballistically to explode in front of the target. Every one of the Voodoos were taken to supersonic speed because the target was at supersonic speed. The combined closing speed was over Mach 3. The fire control electronics, the fire control system electronics, went into time compression abort immediately because they couldn't do the calculations fast enough. The machines were just not designed for that kind of closing speed. That's something we learned from SkyShield. The aircraft that were most successful was the old F-89. We used to call it the lead sled because it was so slow. It was a subsonic airplane. The F-89's attacking from 25,000 feet and snapping, their fire control system was identical to that of the Voodoo, but their speed was half. So they didn't go into a time compression abort, and they were the only aircraft that scored any measurable kills against the B-58 Hustlers. Now, one of the highlights of my career, this SAC tactics and training officer that was there as an observer to see how his boys did as they came through our radar coverage, apparently I impressed him with my knowledge and my skill and my understanding of what had happened, that I was the only no-form at the SAC debriefing for how they had done flying their tactics that would be used against the Russians, against us. And I went down to, was it Barksdale Air Force Base, 8th Air Force headquarters anyway. And of course, you get frisked before you go into the room and everything else. But I was pretty proud to be there and trusted to be in the SAC inner sanctum, if you like. If Curtis LeMay, the strategic commander, had known a Canadian was there, he might have had me shot, but I'm kidding. That
That's awesome.
was a highlight. It's never been done since, grounding air traffic to do training. But they felt they had to do an all-out with, because in every other mission with it, with civilian traffic around, you were very limited in how you could design the mission.
Okay, well, just as a clarification, SAC was
Strategic Air Command.
Strategic Air Command, and you also mentioned Sky Shield, Operation Sky
That was
Shield.
the title they gave to this big air defense exercise, and wherein they grounded all civilian traffic for a 12, well, maybe not a 12-hour period, but it was perhaps an 8-hour period. The only other time all air traffic have been grounded in North America was after 9/11. But they were all grounded for this exercise, which shows these strength of the military politically at the time of that height of the Cold War. This was right after the Cuban Missile Crisis. You know, how good are we going to be if there is a war? Course, none of that took into account, that Sky Shield exercise, the effect of intercontinental ballistic missiles. You know, they would have also been happening in a real war. So, you know, our base and our fighters may not have even been there if a missile had got them first, you know. So it's questionable how much they learned, but they did learn that their air ta I think SAC learned that their air tactics were very effective. And I mean, they're still using B-52s. But Strategic Air Command no longer exists.
Okay. You in your in your biography, you also there was also mention of gaining command of a NORAD region at some point. Could you elaborate as to your experiences with that?
When I was assigned as the commanding officer of 22 AC&W squadron at, which was, no, I'm sorry, not 22, 21 radar squadron at St. Margaret's, New Brunswick, we had a Buick B backup intercept control, BUIC, to a Buick 3 facility. This was a small computerized facility that backed up the big SAGE complex, semi-automatic ground environment complex. It was a new generation electronics because it had transistors. It was an upgrade from tubes to transistors. So it was much smaller, but had strong capacity. In the event that North Bay went down for any reason, let's say somebody sabotaged their cooling system. They had hundreds of millions of vacuum tubes and tons of air conditioning. A good way to sabotage that facility would be to shut down the air conditioning. So they would be off the air. Then we would take over the region, which was by then called Northern NORAD region, and run the air battle from there. Presumably, any surviving senior officers, higher than the rank of lieutenant colonel at least, would come down to assume command eventually. But in the meantime, I actually would have been the Northern NORAD region commander for that brief period until another officer could come in and relieve me to go back to my job as the director of operations, if you like. That was interesting. There was a full colonel down the road at the base. He was a fighter pilot, combat ready as an air defense fighter pilot. So theoretically, he could come down. He's only 12 miles away. And if he wasn't needed at his base, he could have done that. Or they could fly an officer, a senior officer in from North Bay or whatever. That was the highlight of my career. Being a commanding officer, for one thing, is you end up with several hundred people and married quarters and site discipline, you know, among the teenagers and the kids that might be vandalizing your stop signs or whatever can happen. So you have that commanding officer's role as a leader. It was so that, I guess, because it was my second command, I had commanded 22 ACNW squadron at Gander as well. But that was just a little radar squadron, not electronically tied to the SAGE system. It was an outlying radar. And we ran intercepts against Russian aircraft if they intruded into our radar coverage. So if we knew the Russians had come through the Greenland, Iceland, UK gap, there was warning fence there. Two Russian bears have come through the Gayak, as it was called. We would deploy two aircraft from Chatham, New Brunswick to Gander to sit on detachment. And one time that it happened, the bear continued into our radar coverage. They were usually on their way to Cuba. They weren't strategic bombers, actually, they were maritime patrol aircraft doing anti-submarine patrol. But nonetheless, we always wanted to show the Russians we had the capability. So I had the unusual circumstance of being a controller that controlled against, in those days, against a real Russian bear. And the intercept took place about 200 miles southeast of Gander, Newfoundland, probably straight off of St. John's. And the two Voodoos flew up beside the bear and they waved at each other and broke off and came home.
And just to further go into your biography, there's also mention of the working on the backscatter radar project. Could you?
After a staff assignment to North Bay, and this is another highlight I should mention now, before I answer that specific question. I went into Air Defense Command, Canadian Air Defense Command headquarters, into the Senior Staff Officer Ground Environment office as a captain, working for a lieutenant colonel who was Senior Staff Officer Ground Environment, responsible for operation standards and training at all radar sites across Canada that Air Defense Command controlled. While I was there, the Americans declared that they were going to shut down all their Labrador radars, St. Anthony, Stephenville. I'm not sure whether Red Bank might have already been closed by then, but it meant three radars in Labrador. Goose Bay was American manned. Three radars along the coast in Labrador, Stephenville and St. Anthony, and I guess the radar at St. John's. And I was asked by my boss to do a study, a formal staff study, an appreciation of what the effect was going to be on air defense and what we should do about it. And normally a study like that would be something you would expect to get 6 weeks to do. And we had only two. And I worked virtually night and day for 2 weeks trying to gather all the information and argue there is a specific format for a military study in which you lay out all the factors, then you lay out all the options, optional responses, and then you conclude. He liked my paper so well that he only changed about one line in it. He found something. I had brought up something new in the conclusion, and you cannot discuss something new in the conclusion if it wasn't in the body. You understand that, I think, as a staff study. So we corrected that. And other than that, it went as is. National Defense Headquarters didn't expect a study, they just asked for our view. That was really the only a definitive study they had to table when they had to go before the council, the very senior staff, to decide what to do. The final decision was that Canada would man Goose Bay. I think we may have already been manning Gander, but that we would just let the others go. So Stephenville closed, the three, Hopedale, Cartwright, and Saglac, I think, all just closed. That's been readdressed in the new modern system. But that was, my boss subsequently went to a promotion board. And normally you were eligible for promotion from captain to major after, I think it was 4 or 5 years. I had been 12 years a captain, out in on the front lines, if you like, of the radar system, doing good work. But it was always said you could never get promoted unless you did some staff work at headquarters. So I finally took a staff assignment. First thing that happened to me was a staff study. The next thing that happened is my boss was the chairman of the promotion board, the officers promotion board for fighter controllers, and I got promoted. On top of that, I got posted to a really highly desirable, by most people who went there, exchange position with the U.S. Air Force Aerospace Defense Command in Colorado Springs, not in NORAD, but at Aerospace Defense Command as an exchange officer working with Americans. I think there were only three Canadian exchange officers in the whole headquarters, and I was one of them. My project was, to your question, over the horizon backscatter radar development. During my 2 years there, we wrote a statement of work, or a request for proposals, and then a statement of work to establish the parameters for the radar and how it would be designed. And it included making a decision between two types of, when the proposals came in, one was for what they called a pulse Doppler type radar, and the other was an FMCW, frequency modulated continuous wave transmitter that did Doppler analysis of a steady signal. Now, the over the horizon backscatter radar bounces signals off of the ionosphere so that it can see nominally around 1800 to 2000 miles. I took that project up to and including a statement of work, and including defending it, it was going to be canceled by the budget people in U.S. Air Force headquarters. And the Air Force Council had a special meeting to decide the fate of OVHB, over the horizon backscatter radar. My general had to go to defend the project, which our commanding general wanted to continue. I had to write the briefing for the general. All the words were mine, all of the slides were mine, and I had to attend him, but the Air Force Council's no form. I had to sit outside in a chair, while the council met in the inner chambers. If there had been questions my general couldn't answer, I would have been called in to testify specifically for that question, and then have to leave the room before listening to any further commentary. We were successful and saved the program. He wrote a letter that said I could walk on water to my headquarters. He was so pleased because it got him promoted, I think. So, you know, things happen. You want to stop the tape for a minute?